talk here today. Secondly, that this work was developed in collaboration with Oscar Dias, who is here in the audience and to whom you can ask all complicated questions, to Paulo Figueiras, a postdoc at Durham, with Ricardo Monteiro, a PhD student in Cambridge, and with Roberto Amparan, currently at the University of Barcelona. I would also like to talk about some of our ongoing work with the same Iberian team, but now as well with the company of Harvey Real. Okay, so I'm here this morning to talk about instabilities and new phases of higher dimensional black holes. It seems thus natural to start to explain why I think this is an important topic. Well, the main motivation comes from string theory, because string theory contains gravity and lives in more than four dimensions, and actually can formulate it in a consistent way up to 10 dimensions. The second motivation, also string inspired, comes from the AABS CFT correspondence that relates a D-1 dimensional quantum field theory without gravity with a D-dimensional theory of gravity. So the more we know about this D-dimensional theory of gravity, the better we are. Another motivation comes from the possibility of having extra large extra dimensions. In this case, the Planck scale that we observe nowadays is just related with the fundamental physics scale in higher dimensions through a volume factor. In particular, if this volume factor is big enough, then we might observe black holes at the LHC. We'll never know. Another motivation, a more mathematical one, is related to the fact that, in general relativity, the number of dimensions is just a parameter. So in particular, we can try to understand why four dimensions is so distinctive by varying this parameter. And note that we expect more and more intricate geometries as we go up in dimensions, because we have more and more rotation planes, so we expect more and more dynamics. Okay? So I hope this convinces you that it's important to actually study the phase diagram of black holes. And here we'll define black hole as something that has an horizon and that is stationary. Okay? Now, to actually construct these phase diagrams, which typically gives the entropy as a function of the angular momentum and so on, one actually needs to go absolutely nonlinear. But this is an Herculean job if you go up and up in dimensions, because the equations start to get more and more messy as you go up in dimensions. In a certain sense, they become more and more nonlinear. So here, we'll take a more humble approach. We'll look at perturbations of known solutions in higher dimensions. And if we find stationary perturbations, then this will indicate, at least at the perturbative level, that we have new solutions in general relativity. Okay? So this is the plan of my talk. First, I'll review what we know about the asymptotically flat black holes. Then I'll review the Gregor-Laffan instability. I'll present the line elements that we are going to perturb. I'll give the heuristic arguments put forward by Myers and Amparan for why we expect this black hole to be unstable. And I'll present the numerical method that allowed us to actually solve the problem. I'll present the results. I'll give some discussion and physical interpretation of the results. And then, if I still have time, I'll discuss the perturbations around the equal angular momenta Myers-Perry solution, which, as you'll see, will be more interesting. I'll then present the results, and I'll end up with a discussion and conclusions. Okay? So what do we know about asymptotically flat black holes? Well, in four dimensions, we can claim we know it all. Okay? Because there is a uniqueness theorem that, given the angular momenta and the mass of the black hole, there's only one solution, which is the Kerr solution. And furthermore, one can prove that it's stable. Okay. Now, if you go up in the dimension ladder up to five dimensions, we know that none of this actually goes through, or at least part of this does not go through. In particular, there is no uniqueness theorem giving only the mass and the angular momenta at infinity. Okay, not even in the same topological class. To show this,
you mean against metric perturbations, or you write on any?
And as long as it's Kerr, you can write Maxwell equation on this background, scalar field equation on this background, whatever you want, it will be stable.
No, that's not true.
What?
The Kerr black hole, this, sorry, we don't know that Kerr black hole is unstable. It's stable for all types of perturbations. In fact, mass perturbations would have infinite associated
with them. No, because what happens is that these modes that you're talking about are the super radiant modes. But because there is no mass potential at infinity, oh no, sorry.
For a massive
one. No, for a massive one, you're right. For a massive one, yes. For a massive one, there are super radiant poles in particular. But for, yeah, you're absolutely right, for a massive one. But here we're only considering massless perturbations. But you're absolutely right. Now, one can draw the phase diagram to show this explicitly of the single spinning Myers-Perry solution and the.
the ring discovered by Amparin and Rial. And the phase diagram that I'm going to plot here will be the entropy as a function of the angular momentum, okay? The black curve is just the Myers-Perry solution, the one that we know and love. And then the red, the black curve and the red curve is just the single spinning Amparin and Rial solution. There is a window in J, in the angular momentum, for which you can find the three different solutions with different horizon area. But for this region, we have the thin ring, the Myers-Perry solution, and the flat ring. Note that even in the same topological class, we don't have uniqueness because we have the thin ring and the flat ring, okay? Regarding stability, we know something. We know that at least for a certain sector that is considerably interesting, and when the angular momenta are equal, we know that the perturbations, at least for metric perturbations, we know that it's stable. This was a work done by Murata et al. Now, if we further go up in the dimension ladder to D bigger or equal than 6, the only solution that we have analytically, explicitly, that we can write down is a Myers-Perry solution, okay? There has been some numerical work to study black holes with different topological horizons, different from a spherical topology, but all of these solutions have conical singularities. Now, there is a regime in which one can consider that one of the angular momentums of the solution is really, really, really large. One can integrate out the small degrees of freedom and get an effective action for how the horizon wraps certain cycles inside the background that we're considering. This is the so-called black fold approach. I will not dwell on this approach, but I'll try to make a connection a bit further on. Okay, this was put forward by Amparin and others. Okay, but before actually discussing the instability that I want to claim that we have discovered, let me just remind you that we also have other kinds of black holes, even vacuum black holes, which are strings and brains. And here I will define a black brain as a black hole with a non-compact spatial horizon. This will be my definition, no charges included here, okay? Now, in D equals 4, there is no such a thing. And as it will be apparent later, this does not exist in D equals 4, because in dimension equal to 3, Einstein's gravity is essentially trivial. There's no propagating degrees of freedom. So how do we go about to construct this in higher dimensions? Well, it's easy. You pick your favorite d-dimensional black hole. You add n extra dimensions like this, with no non-trivial warping between the two. And this will be a solution of Einstein's gravity as long as the black hole is a solution of d-dimensional Einstein's gravity. Now, a key property of these brains is that actually they are unstable, okay? And this was first pointed out by Gregory Laflamme in 93, where they used this black hole as the Tangerlini solution, basically the Schwarzschild solution in generalized to all dimensions. And it was proved by myself, Ricardo Monteiro, and Malcolm Perry, that in the case that this black hole actually is curved, the instability is still there. This was proved early this year, okay? Let me just, as an aside, I will not talk about non-vacuum solutions, but actually can make the charged strings and the ADS black strings stable, but they have more complex line elements, and this is not the scope of this problem, okay? Now, because the ultra-spinning instability is intimately connected with the Gregor Laflamme instability, I will just explain why we expect, or why is it that the black strings are unstable. Okay, so this is the line element of the black string. So for a constant X surface, we just find the Schwarzschild black hole, and I'm just considering here the Schwarzschild black hole for concreteness. And what we are going to do is to perturb this black string in a sinusoidal way. Note that we can do this because d by dx is a Killing vector of the background, so we are allowed to do this, okay? So we'll give this form for the metric perturbations. Plus, because there is no non-trivial warp factor between this guy and this guy, there's actually a gauge choice that puts a zero here, okay? Furthermore, Gregory and Laflamme proved that the only place where you can get an instability is when this AJB, which is a four-dimensional metric, in the case that this is Schwarzschild, is a spherical wave. What I mean here by spherical wave, this is a perturbation, a metric perturbation that preserves the entire SO3 symmetry of the background solution. Now, again, because d by dt is a Killing vector of my background, I can expand it as the exponential of omega t. Okay, and now what we want to do is very clear. Given 1k, we want to find 1 omega. If omega is positive, the string is unstable, okay? Typically, because we're dealing with gravitational perturbations, we still have an issue of gauge choice. And actually, we restrict the gauge to be in the traceless transverse gauge. Okay, so we impose this gauge condition. Now, if we plug in this metric ansatz into the perturbed version of Einstein's equations, we get the following. We get that the perturbed version of the Einstein equations in five dimensions, or in four plus n dimensions, is just equivalent to a modified version of the perturbed Einstein equations, where basically the graviton has a mass term. Okay? So this is an eigenvalue problem for lambda. That's how you can regard this. Where this delta L is just the Lichner-Obicz operator, as long as you are in the traceless transverse gauge, and is defined by this expression here. The only thing that I wanted to take home is that this is a second order partial differential equation, okay, typically. Now, in this case, because our ansatz is just spherically symmetric, it just gives ODEs. It gives a single ODE. You can put it in a computer, solve it numerically, and see what you get. Remember, given 1k, we want to find omega. This is what one gets, and this is what actually Gregorov found. We found this nice dispersion relation. So on the vertical axis, I have the frequency, or the imaginary part of the usual frequency, if you want. And I have the wave number on the horizontal axis, okay? Now, the first thing that is absolutely obvious is that if the wave number is smaller than a critical wave number, which I marked here by a dot, then the string is unstable. But in other words, if the wavelength of the perturbation is bigger than a certain critical wavelength, then the string is unstable. And furthermore, this critical wavelength is of the order m, okay, it's proportional to m. Now, typically, what one does is actually to compactify these extra dimensions. But if you compactify the extra dimension, then not all values of k of the wave number are allowed. Actually, only integer multiples of 2 pi over r are allowed. In particular, if the compactification circle is small enough, the first allowed mode by the expansion can lie outside this region, thus leading to a string that is stable. Okay? So if you compactify, you can actually make the string stable. Now, the most important thing, at least for what I want to say about this plot, lies in this point. This is a very special point. This point, as was pointed out by Gubser in the beginning, it's a deformation of the string that is non-uniform and that is static. Okay? So he conjectured that this point here should lead to a new non-uniform phase of black strings, okay, that are static. And the reason why they're static is that omega at this point is actually zero. Okay? Now, the full phase diagram of static solutions of the black string, in my opinion, was only fully understood very recently by Toby Weissman et al. There is a very intricate complicated phase diagram for non-uniform strings, and in my opinion, this was only accomplished by Weissman et al. Very recently. So the plots that I'm going to show you next are not supposed to be any sort of time evolution. I'm just going to move around in the moduli space of static solutions, okay? First, we start with a uniform string, okay? Now, we crank up the energy, and at a certain stage, we hit a new phase of black holes, which are the non-uniform strings. This is the point predicted by Gubser, okay? Now, if you further increase the energy, actually what you'll be led to will be going to this kind of non-uniform string, which pinches off completely at where this had a minima. Now this one pinches off completely, and this solution is actually has a conical singularity. This is the so-called Cole's merger, okay? If you further increase the energy, always along the same branch of solutions, you'll get localized black holes. Okay? Now, I will need this picture, so keep this picture in your mind because I want to make a connection with the black hole approach, okay? So this seems a natural point to ask if anyone has questions.
Your work of this being black hole case, how does the growth rate get affected by the spin? Does it go down?
We didn't determine the growth rate. We actually only determined the equivalent of this point.
Oh, okay.
Because we were studying this in the context of the negative mode, of the thermodynamic negative mode of the curve.
How does that point move around then, in particular as you approach
the stream? You'll see, I'll show, because this is a particular case of the single spinning Myers-Briggs solution, so I'll show it. Thank you.
When you do the perturbation stuff, how do you check to make sure that the unstable perturbations that you get are not pure gauge.
Oh, that is easy in this case. And the reason why it's easy is because from the four-dimensional perspective, this reduces to an equation like this, where lambda, if you recall, is just k dot k, which is negative, okay? Now, this guy is also in the traceless transverse gauge. And actually, you can prove that, so the gauge transformation that you're talking about is just this one.
Yeah.
Okay, and you can prove that the Lishnarovitz operator acting on such a thing always gives zero. Always.
Okay.
For every psi b. But if on the other side you have lambda h a b,
okay.
And there is no way. But actually that's a good point. Thank you for asking. You'll see why this is a good point in a few slides. It's a very important point. Okay. So now I will present you the line element of the single spinning Myers-Perry solution. Okay? So here it is. I don't want you to memorize anything about this line element, except the following thing. It has a curl-like part that is warped, there's a warp factor here, over an SP minus 4 sphere. That's the only thing that I want you to take home. Plus, there are two parameters involved in this solution, A and Rm, which you can relate with the asymptotic charges at infinity, the mass of the black hole and the ratio of the angular momentum over the mass. Okay? Now, for t equals 4, this line element just gives our curved black hole. And you know that the angular momentum is bounded by externality. Okay? For t equals 5, the angular momentum is also bounded. But exactly where we would expect externality, we have a naked singularity. Okay? That's actually the point where it connects to the ring solution. Now, the interesting physics occurs if you are in deep equilibrium densities. Because then you can increase A as much as you want. And this amounts to say that this function here that defines the location of the horizon always has a real root. Okay? So if you can speed it up, let's do it, because that's a feature that you cannot do it in four dimensions. Let's spin up this solution. But before doing that, let me just remind you that the horizon of this black hole is made out of two components. Okay? The spatial horizon. So if you fix dt to a constant and dr to a constant, there's a part here that looks like normal curve, so it's a spheroid, and then there's a transverse sphere, okay? As you start to crank up the angular momentum, what happens is that the curve part starts to look more and more and more and more like a pancake, okay? With a typical radius of given by the rotation parameter A. The transverse sphere, on the other hand, gets a typical size of r plus. And because r plus, the location of the horizon decreases with A, this sphere is becoming smaller and smaller and smaller as the sky is increasing and increasing and increasing, okay? So locally, at least for this guy, for the transverse sphere, this looks like a plane, like a two-plane, okay? So locally, we have a d-2 black hole, whose spatial horizon is given by this, cross a two-plane. But this, because this looks like a string, this has to be unstable. So this argument was put forward by Roberto and Rob in 2003. Okay. Actually, you can be a bit more precise. And what one can do is to zoom near the polar cap, that's the part that is becoming flatter and flatter and flatter, taking A to plus infinity and keeping this information about the mass. And when you do that, actually what you get is exactly the line element of d-2 black hole cross a two-plane. So this is exactly locally like a string, thus we expect it to be unstable. Okay? Now we can borrow something that we learned from the non-uniform strings and try to apply it here. Again, this is no time evolution, we're just going to move along the moduli space of solutions. So we start with our favorite solution, we increase the rotation, at a certain stage, we should find a solution that is only slightly pinched near the polar cap. This will be the equivalent of the Boomser point, okay? And this is what we want to determine. This is the point that we want to determine, okay? What I'm going to say now is not, what I'm going to say next, is not a theorem. It's speculation, but we truly believe that exists. If we start to follow this solution, at a certain stage, you should find a singular solution that pinches off completely here. So you started off, it's slightly pinched off, and now you pinched off. So the distance between the two poles is actually zero. This solution, again, should be singular and should be the equivalent of the Cole merger. If you actually go up in rotation, you get to the black premium. And when you get here, the rotation is really big. It's really high already. And this is the part that is captured by the black hole approach. Okay. So, but remember, what you want to determine is this. Now that we know what you want to determine, I have to tell you how the hell did we determine this. And to do this, I'll have to talk about the spectral methods that we use. To my knowledge, and this might just be my lack of knowledge, this was first applied in the gravitational context by myself, Malcolm Perry, and Ricardo Montaigne. And there, the equation that we have to solve is something like this. Which the Robbins operator that you saw equals lambda HAV. Now, the procedure is almost childish. What we are going to do is to discretize the space in which this guy lives into a non-uniform grid. Okay? That's what we are going to do. Then, to put in a vector the values of this guy at each point on the grid. Okay? And now, derivatives, what the derivatives do is just to mix adjacent points to make a derivative. That's a normal expansion that we do. Such that this very complicated operator, in the end, just reduces to a matrix equation. Okay? This is pretty much in the spirit of quantum mechanics, if you think of it. Now, if the discretization is good, in the limit where we increase the number of points, we expect these two things to be equal, if the discretization is good. But at this stage, you are wondering, why are you choosing a non-uniform bit? Surely choosing a uniform bit would be easier. Why do you want to do this? Actually, these points are not random points that we are going to choose. They're given by the extreme of the Chebyshev polynomial.
And based on that, you can prove a bunch of statements proved by mathematicians. So the advantages are the following. First, we have exponential accuracy with increasing n. And actually, we check this numerically, and it is true. We do indeed have exponential accuracy. Secondly, there is no Runge phenomenon. This is basically related with the fact that if you try to have interpolations on an equidistant basis, on an equidistant grid, and fix the boundary conditions, near the boundary, you have worse and worse numerics. But because these points cluster near the boundaries, we have better and better numerics. It's better and better, better control. And secondly, and thirdly, and this was the most important bit, is that none of us is an expert in numerics of the people that did this work. So it is a very good advantage that there are loads of powerful methods to solve generalized eigenvalue problems, which are of this sort, and that we don't have to write them, because Mathematica will have it. And actually, all that I'm about to say was only done in Mathematica, nothing else. That's the only thing that we use. The disadvantages of this are quite clear. First, because there is a non-uniform grid, the matrices are more complex, and typically, they're more dense. And actually, they have a particular form, which is toplets. And in a particular case of toplets, it is circulant. And this amounts to say that even though the matrix is dense, these powerful methods can take these symmetries into account to actually being able of solving this in a normal computer, because we don't have supercomputers at Cambridge. We have to use a normal PC. The biggest problem, as was pointed out to me 2 days ago by Luis, is that actually this is all very well, but the perturbed metric functions need to be analytic, OK? And the reason for this is that you're using Chebyshev polynomials, and because Chebyshev polynomials are analytic functions, you expect this to only work for analytic functions, which is indeed the case in our approach, as you'll see. Okay? Now, at this stage, you're like, this guy is kidding with me, because this is not the equation that I want to solve. I want to see on the right-hand side, I want to see zero. So the equation that we really want to solve is this one. The Lichtenrovich operator acting evaluated on the single spinning background solution equals to zero. So what the Iberian team decided to do was to deform this equation and to put this new term on the right-hand side. Generically, if you do this just to a bunch of equations, the numerics will be completely screwed up. There's nothing that you can do. But actually, the presence of this term is also motivated by physics, because we know that as long as this term is negative, this is actually the same equation for a string where the background solution is now the single spinning Myers-Perry solution. Okay, just like we saw for the uniform string. Also, this equation can be motivated by thermodynamics as long as the lambda is negative, if you're searching for negative modes in thermodynamics. Okay. Now it is clear what we are going to do. We're going to discretize this, find all values of lambda, and in the end, look for the negative modes that cross zero. The ones that actually cross zero are solutions with a zero on the right-hand side, and those are solutions to our original problem. So this is a trick. Again, a very childish trick, but it proved to be useful. Now, what I've told you, we have a numerical method. I didn't tell you which perturbation we are going to look at, and which symmetry does this perturbation have to obey. So we are going to search for solutions that do not spoil the symmetries of the background. And the background solution only has one d by dt symmetry, a u1 that is guaranteed by Hawking's residuality theorem generalized to higher dimensions. And then we are not going to mess up the sphere. We're going to keep up the same symmetry of the sphere. Okay? So the most general solution that you can write down for the perturbation equations, as long as you restrict to solutions that obey to this symmetry, is the one shown here. Okay, where, let me just draw your attention, the only thing that you're going to do in front of the sphere is to perturb the warped factor. Okay, the rest, you just keep it like this. A priori, we have 7 functions. However, we still have to deal with the issue of gauge invariance, because general relativity is diffeomorphic invariance at the linear level. This means that there is a symmetry of equations of motion given by this, where psi b is just a gauge parameter. The gauge that we are going to choose is actually the traceless transverse gauge, okay? And as was cunningly pointed out before, the traceless transverse gauge actually fixes all the gauge as long as lambda is different from zero because of the reasons that I already told you, okay? However, for lambda exactly equal to zero, we might be wondering if we're getting gauge modes because this guy doesn't exist on this side, okay? Now, we can impose the condition on this transformation that this new part is also traceless and transverse. This amounts to say that the gauge parameter has to obey to box psi a equals zero and divergence of psi a equals zero. However, we have boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions are such that the metric perturbation is regular on the horizon and preserves the asymptotic planes. Plus, we want h a b to be of a specific form, which is the form that I've shown you before. And under these assumptions, you can prove analytically, not numerically, analytically, that this has no solutions. Okay? Analytical work. So this is not numerics at this stage. So this means that even for lambda equal to zero, the gauge freedom is fixed. Okay? Which is something good. Okay. The first miracle, in my opinion, is that actually some of the metric functions that I showed you appear algebraically in the traceless transverse condition. And this means that we can solve for these guys as a function of 4 remaining quantities and their derivatives, okay? Because the gauge symmetry is a symmetry of our equations of motion, this means that solving the equations of motion tt, t phi, and phi phi, sorry, that solving the hr, hr theta, h theta theta in the warp factor equations automatically solves the other ones, because this is a manifestation of gauge freedom. There's nothing new here. So in the end, we started with 7 functions. We killed 3 by gauge symmetry. We are left with 4. So what we have to solve is a system of 4 coupled PDEs in HRR, HR theta, H theta theta, H omega, the warp factor that depend on R and theta. Okay? Now we have a method. We know what to search for. The only thing that I'm missing are the boundary conditions. What are the boundary conditions? The best way to deal with boundary conditions, at least at the linear level, is by far to go to look at our original line element, to go to Eddington Finkelstein coordinates, and to pick up a regular tetrad on the horizon. We rewrite our metric perturbations by projecting on this tetrad and by going to Eddington Finkelstein coordinates. And in these coordinates and in this tetrad, the metric, the boundary conditions are very simple. And the boundary conditions are such that the metric cannot be, the metric perturbation cannot be special there. That means the metric functions there cannot be zero or cannot diverge. But recall, in this regular tetrad and in Eddington Finkelstein coordinates, okay? When you trace back to see what happens in your original coordinates and you're in your original tetrad, these are the boundary conditions that you get. That the metric perturbations diverge and all the others, sorry, the HRR diverges and all the others are constants. Basically, you can trace back this to the fact that GRR, the background metric, already diverges like this. Now, the boundary conditions at infinity are just that all of these guys actually go to zero, okay? This is more tricky to show, but for the boundary conditions that we have, and if strictly speaking, if you are at infinity because there's exponential decay, these are the boundary conditions.
guess I don't quite understand that. I mean, it's certainly true that in the original coordinate system, things diverge. But if you're actually using Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, you know, so not T, but, you know, V, then nothing should be divergent. Not background and not
perturbation. Again, good question. But these are really the original. This R. Uh-huh. Okay. And this is really in the original tetrad and in the original Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates.
It's
coordinate system, not Eddington-Finkelstein.
Okay.
Why not solve directly the Eddington-Finkelstein where everything's regular?
I don't know. We started here.
We could have done it.
It's just that we started. Actually, the way that I can actually talk to that question in a different way. We initially started to perturb the metric by looking at the metric. So this is the perturbed plus unperturbed bit, as in something like this, for instance, where this guy was small. And since this guy diverges, we wanted to recover something like that. But you could do it in that Eddington-Finkelstein coordinate, so I agree completely.
What's the ball freak like?
Sorry?
What's the ball freak going?
So you're saying they go to infinity? How do they go?
As long as lambda is negative, it goes exponential.
Okay.
And this is related to the fact that you have massive gravity. So you can tail back this to a. When you actually hit zero, it goes as a power law.
Okay.
And I don't remember by heart. But it goes as a power law, and I can give you the details of the computation. It depends on the dimension. And actually, we have this much better under control in the different system. I really want to have time to talk about the other system. Okay? More questions? Okay. So now we have the boundary conditions, we have a numerical method. And we know what to search for. Let's do it. So these are the results for 4 and 5 dimensions. And they're very similar. I'm going to display what happens in 4 dimensions. So this answers to your question, Rob. This is exactly in 4 dimensions. The negative mode goes like this. OK? The negative mode that you asked for decreases with increasing gain. OK? Now, the only difference between 4 and 5 dimensions, so this is a negative mode, but I trace back the negative mode as being the critical wavelength of the string. That's why you see k squared here, OK? Normalized to the mass radius.
So that means that decreases, but it gets more?
More and more negative. OK, the negative mode. Now, you can actually, thermodynamically, this is all explained in our paper.
You were expecting this, thermodynamically.
X is just the rotation. Rotation versus a negative mode. The negative mode is increasing this way.
So
k squared will be positive.
So the wavelength is getting larger or smaller, is right?
The wavelength, so k is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So the wavelength is getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
It gets more unstable.
Yes. That's what we talked about yesterday. Now, the only difference between 4 and 5 dimensions is that actually at extremality, this is finite, OK? But once you are in 5 dimensions, it's not finite. It diverges as this.
And this is very likely connected with the fact that we're approaching a naked singularity, OK? Now, the interesting physics appears when you go up in dimension.
So the negative mode is finite at extremality?
Yes. No, this is finite. This is finite here.
Well, the Kirby code doesn't
go to 1. No, because this is a mass radius. If you trace back to my definition, the mass radius is a half of the mass, basically.
Okay.
Just a matter of normalization. Now, if you go up in dimensions, very interesting physics starts to happen. First, in 6 dimensions, the numerics is C.
And this is usually the case even for black non-uniform strings. In 6 dimensions, the metric is sick, and this is probably most likely due to the weak asymptotic decay of the metric function, namely of delta, that falls as 1 over r. This is also happens in the case of the Gregor-Laplanian stability, in the case of the non-uniform strings in 6 dimensions. Now, in 7 dimensions, we get, instead of getting 1 negative mode, we get a bunch of them. Plus, if you go up in dimensions, not much is changed. Again, we get a bunch of negative modes. Just by looking at this, one immediately concludes that we have a new physics because we have more and more Gregor-Laplanian instabilities as we go up in dimensions, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. But lo and behold, and this is the crucial point, some of these negative modes actually cross zero. So whenever they cross zero, we have a solution to our original problem, not to the string problem, to our original problem, okay? But now we are a bit confused. Why do you get so many? 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So to understand this, let's label these curves from left to right as L equals 0, L equals 1, L equals 2, and so forth, okay? Now, to explain what L equals 1 is, I need to recall, remind you of a heuristic argument that Rob and Roberto put forward for why the instability should first kick in, okay? Now, recall that what was crucial is that the Myers-Perry solution started to have, for small values of rotation, would have a curl-like behavior and then would approach a membrane-like behavior. So you pick your favorite thermodynamical quantity, in this case they pick the temperature, and we are going to see when this temperature goes from having a curl-like behavior to a membrane-like behavior, okay? To see where this happens, we can actually check the minimum of this temperature. The minimum of this temperature, if you use Smart's relation, is the same as the second derivative of the S with respect to the angular momenta at fixed mass, and you find the critical value for this A. This is a rough estimative of where this should appear. Now, again, for values of A smaller than this, the temperature and the entropy decreases like in the Kerr black hole. But just after this, they rapidly approach the membrane-like behavior, okay? What is remarkable is that L equals 1 doesn't appear slightly above of this or slightly below. It appears exactly there, and this to a precision of 10 minus 5. Okay, or 10 to the minus 3. It appears exactly there. So it seems that L equals 1 is a thermodynamic mode because we're calculating something on the background solution. It really looks like a thermodynamic mode, okay? So very likely, this mode is connecting to another Myers-Perry solution with a different angular momenta and with a different mass, okay? And really, on generic grounds, you can prove that whenever the Hessian of the entropy with respect to the angular momenta at fixed mass crosses 0, you expect to have zero mode, yeah.
You know, something about numerics comes out to a precise analytic answer that's a clue that maybe, you know, there's sort of a closed form solution, you know, that you could find analytically rather than numerically. Have you looked for that?
Yes, and the answer to that question is if you actually go to the line element of the Myers-Perry solutions, differentiate with respect to the mass, differentiate with respect to the angular momentum, and put it back in the traceless transverse sketch, it should give this mode that we find.
Okay.
Now, this is very easy to say. I have to do this, I have to do that, and then plug it in and see if it gets back. The problem is to actually plug it in the traceless transverse sketch, it's a pain. So we have not done that. But I will convince you using a very different argument that this is true, if I have time. Okay? Not in this setup, in a different setup.
Well, I mean, coming up with a coordinate transformation to put it into the transverse traceless gauge could be tricky. But if you think of the transverse traceless gauge as looking for a vector field xi, such that, you know, when you add symmetrized derivative of xi to your thing, you get something that's transverse and traceless. That, you know, actually sounds a little bit more doable.
Yeah, but that's exactly what they try to do, and that's tricky. That's so tricky. If you have some ideas of that, I'll be able to discuss this. Okay, so
actually can generalize what happens here to higher dimensions. And the generalization is just to look at where the Hessian of the entropy with respect to all of the angular momentum of our solution has a zero mode. Whenever this has a zero mode, we expect this mode to be present. This mode is thermodynamic in nature, should just shift you to another Myers-Perry solution, okay? Now, what happens with the other modes? We have a bunch of them. So because we not only determine the eigenvalues, but also the eigenvectors, we can actually reconstruct the metric perturbation. Now, the key issue here is that if you generically try to do this, even in the background of Kerr, that is to say, if you try to embed the Kerr horizon on a 2D plane, you'll fail to do that after a certain value of the rotation. And this is due to the fact that the Gaussian normal curvature of the manifold gets very, very negative near the poles. So to overcome this, you need to embed it in a four-dimensional space, as was done by Frolov in 2004, okay? But the problem is that this introduces a non-physical cone, which we'll here choose to be at the pole, okay? But you can do it in this way. So this is the result for L equals 2, 3, and 4. Now, this is just embedding. You should look at Z as the polar axis, okay? And X as being the equator, okay? And these are the embeddings of what happens at the horizon. The blue curve is the unperturbed solution. the red curve will always be the perturbed solution, okay? So the background plus the perturbation. Now, if you look at these plots, you cannot learn much because this curve is on the top of that one. So what one does is to take the difference between the two and take the logarithm, okay? And here, it's very clear that whenever this guy crosses, you'll have something going to minus infinity. And because you know that these functions are analytical, because you look at them, and because you know that here the background solution is above the perturbed solution, you can reconstruct what happens by looking at this graphic. So here, the background solution is above the perturbed solution, here is below, and here is above. Okay? And you have a minus sign, a plus, and a minus. Now we can try to reconstruct this in a more pictorial and exaggerated way. And this is this three-dimensional plot. So in the blue, at light blue, I have the unperturbed Myers-Perry solution. And then I have the perturbation on the top of it, which is the red one. And what we start to see, so I'm just reading this plot, but now here. First, the perturbed solution is above. The perturbed solution is below the unperturbed one. Then it's above, and then it's below. This is exactly the solution that we described initially. When I was asking what is the solution that we want to look. So this is a solution that slightly pinches off near the horizon. So eventually this will connect to the black curve. Now the second one is more interesting. Again, the same plot, minus, plus, minus, plus. So minus goes up, minus, plus, minus, plus. This will connect to the black Saturn. Now it's obvious what will happen next. This will connect to the black die ring, which are two rings, one, two. Okay? And plus the L that we talked about is just the number of nodes that our function has. It seems that we have control of what happens here. But if you look at the title of my talk, it says instabilities and new phases of higher dimensional black holes. So far of instabilities, I've told you nothing. Okay? And actually to solve the PDEs in this case with time dependence, it's a bit of a pain. Because we have PDEs, actually, if you include time dependence, the number of metric functions increase. And then you have loads of metric functions. None of us is an expert in numerics, so you have to resort to something smarter. Okay? And that's where Harvey Real came in to help us. So at this point, we turn to the Myers-Perry solution in odd dimensions with all of the angular momenta equal to each other. In that case, one can write the Myers-Perry solution as a co-dimension one manifold. Okay? So this is a manifold that is pretty much like Schwarzschild, except that is rotating. Okay? So it's co-dimension one. Again, I don't want you to take the details of this metric home, except that there is a rotation parameter A, and again that there is a mass radius, and again they're both related with the asymptotic charge rotation of all the angles and the mass of the black hole. So this is the only thing that you have to take home. Again, you can write this in this way, because you use the fact that an odd sphere can be written as a Hopf vibration over CPN, okay? And that's why you have this funny metric on CPN, which you can take to be the study Fubini metric if you want. Then you have this one form whose exterior derivative is just the Keller form on CPN, because CPN is a Keller manifold, okay? Now, pretty much in the same way that you expand perturbations on Schwarzschild in spherical harmonics, well, maybe you can try to expand our perturbations in kind of spherical harmonics or harmonic functions on CPN. But note that this is thought to be non-trivial. And the reason why this is really non-trivial is because there is a coupling between parts of the CPN with psi and t. So we called Harvey. This because Harvey had done this work together with Kunduri, Lucetti, and Martin on how to decompose metrics of this form. The perturbations of this metric in a co-dimension one way. So you expand in spherical harmonics. In such a way that the equations that you get in the end will only depend on T and R, because the dependence on the CPN factors are all contained in the harmonic functions, just like you do for Schwarzschild. Okay? But this is non-trivial. Huh? Okay, but at this stage, you're all wondering, this guy is again fooling me. Because now we have extremality. So how do you know that you can go with your increase the rotation as much as you can and still get interesting physics? Because now you hit a wall, you hit extremality. However, because of Rob and Roberto, we know where we expect interesting physics. It's where the Hessian of the entropy with respect to the angular momentum at fixed mass actually has a zero mode. And we can calculate this. And this is the critical value for which we expect the L equals 1 mode, okay? And the thing is that this value is always smaller than the value at externality, as long as we are in above five dimensions. So 7, 9, and so on. Okay? This is always the case. Plus, the difference between these two values increases as the number of dimension increases. Okay? So the range that we are allowed to have more modes increases as the number of dimension increases. Now we have PDEs in T and R at this stage, because all of the dependence in the CPM is gone. But because T is a time-like filling vector, we can again Fourier expand the modes in this form, e to the omega t. And if actually we find that for a certain a, we get a positive omega, then for the first time, at least that I know, we have an asymptotically flat, compact black hole that is unstable, undoubtedly, if we find a positive or positive omega. Okay. Now, as a sidekick, and for me the sidekick is even more interesting than finding an unstable black hole, is that because we have a controlled expansion on CPN, we can actually see what are the symmetries that are broken by our perturbations. Pretty much in the same way that when you look at Schwarzschild, you know that L equals zero preserves all the symmetry, the L equals zero harmonic preserves all the symmetry of the sphere, then L equals one gives a translation, and so on and so forth. And here you can do the same. And one can prove that there are certain modes in D equals three, in dimension 9, that break all of the symmetries of CP3, okay? The only message that I want to take home is that I want you to take home is that if this happens, then we have a black hole that only has a d by dt and a d by d phi. So it corresponds to a saturation of Hawking's rigidity theorem in higher dimensions. It has much less symmetries than the Myers-Perry solution. In fact, it only has two. This generalization was worked out by Hollands, Ishibashi, and Wald, and by Eisenberg and Moncrief. This will be, in my opinion, a very interesting result. It's just a proof of principle that at least perturbative, you can have black holes that only have two commuting Killing vectors, d by dt and d by d psi. Nothing else. Okay? What are the results? First, let's concentrate in the stationary case. Do the same analysis that we did before, but now for omega equal to zero. Now, again, the L equals one mode, which is a thermodynamic mode, is there, and is there with a precision with 10 to the minus 6. It appears exactly where we predict it should appear, okay? This mode here. And it's there in 7 dimensions, in 8 dimensions, in 9, in 7, 9, 11, 13, it's there in all dimensions that you can hook up. But the interesting physics shows up in 9 dimensions, where besides having the L equals one mode, in the range between extremality and where interesting physics appears, also the L equals two mode appears. And this L equals two corresponds to a perturbative black hole that saturates Hawking's rigidity theorem. So we found a black hole with a compact horizon that saturates Hawking's rigidity theorem, okay? This was actually also advocated by Roberto and others in the black hole approach, where for large angular momenta, they found something that looks like an helicoidal black ring. But this, in my opinion, is more, I wouldn't say more striking. This, in my opinion, it's different. Because here, the topology is still spherically symmetric. We still have a spherical symmetric topology, but still this breaks all the symmetry, except d by dt and d by d phi. Now, let's go to what we really want to see. What about time dependence, finally? So this is the dispersion relation that we get. For L equals 1, and on the vertical axis, we have omega. On the horizontal axis, we have the wavelength. And we see that for L equals 1, in all dimensions, if we want, and for all values of the rotation, which are depicted here with several colors, if we want k equals 0, we necessarily have omega equal to 0. So this is not an instability of the background. And I think this settles the issue. That L equals 1 just moves you along the Myers-Perry solution. It's not an instability. If you have k equals 0, you have omega equal to 0. That's it. OK? And look at the curves are indeed very similar to the curves of the Gregor-Laffan instability, which we expect, because the physics, after all, is the physics of the Gregor-Laffan instability. Even the growth rates attain similar values. Now, more interestingly, if you go up to 9 dimensions, and just, you know, we picked 9 dimensions because we can do the computation in 9 dimensions. Surely this will be in a dimension smaller than this. This is just to prove that in 9 dimensions, because we can do the computation, we do it. And here, much more interesting, because you see we have the wavelength of the perturbation from the perspective of the string. And you have here the growth rate of the instability. And when k is equal to 0, the growth rate is not 0. So this is an unstable black hole, okay? Actually, what we can do now is to pick up a bunch of points for all values of omega that you can think of, all values of k that you can think of, and all values of the rotation parameter. And then in the end, just look at the sector where k is equal to zero. If you do that, and this is the central result of my presentation, in my opinion, you get this dispersion relation, okay? This is the dispersion relation that shows that it's possible to have an unstable black hole that is asymptotically fine, okay? And it's such that, again, it appears where omega is equal to zero, the point that we've seen before, and it grows up. And I think it will be fine at that extremality. Note that it seems that there is some certain difference between extremality and this one, but this is a kind of an illusion, because if you look at this scale, these two guys are very, very close to each other. So we actually can continue to put more points here, okay? So this is the dispersion relation that we were looking for since the beginning, okay? So now I come up to my conclusion. First, asymptotically flat black holes can be unstable. That's what I've shown you. Instabilities often connect different families of black holes. The black hole approach gives a generic picture, but near the merger zone, near where all of these branches of solution actually connect, so far only with numerics. Okay. Now again, these are numerical perturbative results, so we should take it with a certain attention. We need to see if they survive to the nonlinear regime. Now, I truly expect that they will survive. And the reason for that is that in the Gregor Laplace instability, they do survive. And the physics is the same. Okay? But this is not a proof. This is just blah, 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 blah. For that, we need to do the calculations. Okay?
So I'm saying that they're here at the linear level. I see that they satisfy the perturbed equations of motion. It's not clear to me that if they satisfy the perturbed equations of motion, that they will satisfy the full nonlinear equations, Einstein's equations at the nonlinear level, even though it's static. But for that, you need to develop a code that will search for solutions of Einstein.
But to my means, if you are going to put your perturbative solution in the full equation, then you will see the same behavior, right? Mm. Or when the perturbations grow to something non-trivial.
No. I'm not talking about time evolution. I'm just saying that that point corresponds to a new branch of static solutions. But this only indicates that there is a perturbative solution there. What I want to see is to discover these black holes nonlinearly, to have an expression for these black holes at the nonlinear level. No time evolution here.
I mean, there is this old sort of concrete result about linearization stability.
Right.
Sometimes you have solutions of the linear equation that don't correspond to any solution of the full equation.
Exactly.
And it's just
so it's in that context.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. And what I'm saying is that because the physics is so similar to Gregor Laplace instability, and I think there is also a crucial point, is that the instability that we find only has an imaginary part, a purely imaginary part for the frequency. It doesn't have a real one. And I think this means that this is not radiating, at least at the linear level. Okay. What are the plans for the future? They're all, I think, natural. So the first thing that I want to do is to consider time dependence in the single spinning Meyer-Stein solution, PDEs, but from what I heard, that's maybe not the right direction to go. And I also want to break the transverse sphere in the single spinning Meyer-Stein solution to see if also I can get a saturation Hawking reducibility theorem, at least at the linear level, okay? And I think this last point, which is almost done, is the key point. So I have an instability in the equal angular momenta case, okay? And I want to conjecture that this is actually the ultra spinning instability. But I don't have the same geometrical interpretation of the instability. And for that, I need to guarantee that these zero modes of the ultra-spinning instability actually connect to the zero modes that we're finding here in the equal angular momenta case. And for that, I need to concentrate, look at the solution that interpolates between single spinning and equal angular momenta. Okay? And this is work in progress. Hopefully, it will appear soon. Thank you.
Questions.
So when you say instabilities often connect different families, what happens if they don't? So what are they unstable to?
In general relativity, I don't know of any case where this doesn't happen. But in plasma physics, I mean, you have critical points that stop at one place and go nowhere.
So what's your thought on these ones then? What will they?
In general relativity, maybe they, I think in all cases that we know of, they do connect new paradimensional, new phases of like families. But yeah, I don't know. This is an open issue.
Okay. And then you quoted results. I have come in a bit later. Sorry, you quoted results for odd dimensional cases. Do you have anything for even dimensional cases?
No. The reason why I don't have for even dimensional cases is that so far, nobody was able to put that in a four-dimensional form.
And that's an important technical issue, I guess.
Yes, but at which stage of my talk you were, that's what I need to know. So you only arrived at which stage of my talk did you arrive?
Well, I saw you talk about the co-dimension one surfaces.
Okay, so before that, I've talked about the single spinning case, single spinning, which is four-dimension two, and that we can build. In all dimensions, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11,
oh,
and the
okay.
physics is very similar to this one.
Okay.
The only reason why I tackle this one is that here I also can get the rule of rate of instability, and in the other one I can only get the onset of instability, whereas instability is just.
Okay. Sorry.
No, come on.
When you say asymptotically flat, do you mean just they go to the right thing in binomial, or you check that they are asymptotically flat and say that rigid teleports things?
I'm
argue would be a keen on asking this question.
They're asymptotically flat. They're really asymptotically flat in the sense that they approach with the right rate infinity.
Okay. Maybe just a related comment because I've heard of this. So there is a Japanese group who is looking at the ultra spinning black hole frames instability, and it ties to something that goes way back. So there they see that when they start a simulation with one this very high spinning black hole, then the instability sets in. But as we saw in the Gregory Laplan case, it kind of seems to slow down quite a bit. In the process, the black hole is radiating gravitational waves like crazy, and it turns to apparently, well, that's what they tend to kind of to stop. So even though there is no the conjecture they have at the moment, even though you don't have an upper limit of the angular momentum, the dynamics would pick one.
Sounds reasonable to me, and I have no comment to do because this is my analysis.
And they haven't published this yet, so this is
possible. It would be great to actually see that work, because we were in kind of a competition in that group when we did that, when we did this linear analysis. So we probably want to see exactly what are the results.
Yeah, but this is completely different. This is time evolution. What they are doing is time evolution.
You're just moving around.
Nature has its own evolution.
Yeah, sure. I mean, time evolution is definitely more impressive than this one, but this
the
is
fact
what
we could do.
Yeah.
What is that? The fact that they are unstable doesn't mean that they cannot exist.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank George again.